Welcome everybody to session 133, plenty of seats up front. Thank you very much for coming, and I, in my duly appointed calling as session chair, have a few announcements to read. First of all participants speak into the mic because we are being recorded, and during our question and answer period, please use that microphone to ask questions. For the same reason. This time I would like to ask all of you to turn off and silence your cell phones, Blackberries, Blueberries, iPads, iPods, or any other electronic master to which you are in thrall, because they make noise and stuff. Also, I would like to remind you, as I am instructed to, that the bookstore for Sunstone is right next door, and then let's face it, we're kind of all here to plug a book, and so this book and many other fine specimens are available right next door in the Sunstone bookstore. Sunstone apparently gets a cut of everything sold, so buy now and buy often. Okay, I'm just going to
sign,
and we will sign them, yes, which slightly increases its resale value on eBay.
You never know how much an obscure academic's signature.
Could you hold it up again? You kind of wiggled it.
Yes.
What is it?
Peculiar Portrayals. Mormons on the Page, Stage, and Screen. I am going to briefly introduce the members of the panel, and then we'll announce how we will proceed. And first of all, it calls on me to introduce myself. And so I am Michael Austin, and a few things about me that may or may not be relevant. I am a Mormon provost at a very Catholic university in Wichita, Kansas. I am a classically trained literary critic whose primary area of research involves evolution and human cognition, and I have lived openly as a Democrat in Utah, California, West Virginia, and Oklahoma. All of this amounts to the fact that I am pathologically comfortable with contradiction and embrace it on almost a daily basis. My collaborator, my good friend and co-editor, Mark Decker, holds a PhD in English from Penn State University. He is an assistant professor of English at Bloomsburg University in Pennsylvania, part of the state higher education system. He's a great generalist. He's published articles on William Faulkner, Thomas Pynchon, Richard Wright, E.M. Forrester, Charles Brockden Brown. He is also, according to his biography, and I read here, interested in the connection between social thought and speculative fiction, which is academic speak for Star Trek geek.
Star Wars geek.
His most recent essay on this topic is a discussion of George Lucas's attempt to create an audience-friendly critique of industrial society, which appears in the fall 2009 volume of the journal Extrapolation. And finally, Aaron Sanders, one of the contributors to the book, holds a PhD in American Literature from the University of Connecticut and an MFA in Fiction from the University of Utah, and is currently an assistant professor of literature and creative writing at Columbus State University in Georgia. He has written many fine stories and will write many more, appearing in such places as Gulf Coast, Quarterly West, Beloit Fiction Journal, Hawaii Review, etc., etc. I will predict, however, that he will always and forever be known for his story, Sex with Mother, Mormon Style, which was nominated for the 2007 Pushcart Prize. Whatever he writes, that will be on his obituary. Okay. We will proceed then in this order. Mark And I am going to be entirely honest here and say that Mark did do most of the work on this book. And he really is the one who had the genesis, had the germ of the idea for it and nurtured it all the way through to publication. Mark is going to introduce the book and try to kind of set it in a context of what we, mainly he, were trying to do. Then I'm going to read a few very small and hopefully intriguing passages from my article on Big Love. Aaron is going to do the same from his article on various Blood Atonement narratives in contemporary Mormon fiction. And again, I remind you that we are here because we love and value Sunstone and the discourse community that it offers, but we're also here to hawk the book. So if you like what you hear, run, don't walk, to buy Peculiar Portrayals, Mormons on the Page, Stage, and Screen.
Who's the publisher of that?
Utah State University Press.
Mike, I'm glad to say that our book is cheap compared to most academic books. Anyway, I would also like to say a little thank you to NBC Universal for letting us use this cover image for Next to Nothing after I sent them along and whiny email about how we were just trying to make back publication costs. So that was good of them. I wanted to, instead of reading my article or my chapter from the book, read a little spiel about where the book came from. And Mike, I didn't do all the work, but if he's going to call me a Star Wars geek, I might as well phrase it this way. This is Yoda, and I'm Luke Skywalker. That's how the book came to being. I won't figure out who Darth Vader was, but anyway, when I first approached, you know, we went through the process and we got to the point where I thought I could start sending out, sample chapters and prospectus to various publishers. I approached my department chair and I explained, you know, what I was doing and that I had lined up, you know, good people. Like Aaron, you know, and others. And the first words out of her mouth were, "Is this a devotional work?" I forgot to mention, at this point, I already had a contract from Utah State. You know, she said, "Is this a devotional work?" And I said, "No." Pulled out the contract. This is University Press. This is scholarship. And, well, you know, Mark, you can't use departmental funds for devotional work. Said, trust me, it's not devotional work. It's a work of scholarship. And I think that misunderstanding sort of illustrates the gap that this book is trying to fill. I'm not saying that people haven't looked at LDS characters. And if you look at the program here, that other people are doing that. But I wanted a book. I wanted a book by a serious, respected academic press. Utah State is smaller than Oxford or Harvard, but they're just as good. And they belong to the same councils and have the same certifications. And so I wanted to enter that conversation. And while it's good to be here at Sunstone, and I hope that a lot of thoughtful LDS and LDS-affiliated or historically LDS people take a look at the book, I wanted to talk to academics. And I wanted to answer some questions. And this is my little spiel, I guess, about the questions that I wanted to at least pose, if not answer. So, fittingly enough, given the press that eventually published the book, the intellectual question that led me to propose the creation of Peculiar Portrayals began to form in my mind in Utah State's Merrill Library. And yes, I'm dating myself because it wasn't the Merrill Kazir Library yet. I was an undergraduate English major researching a paper on Sinclair Lewis, the first American author to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. Lewis also always tried, and let me underscore that, tried, to portray unpopular minorities fairly. And I was unsurprised to find a brief article by Jewish literary critic Barry Gross praising Lewis for his ability to portray not only heroic Jews, but also normal, even mediocre Jews. Gross was especially impressed with Lewis's quotidian Jews because the author was writing during an era when authors like F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway, and pretty much, fill in the blank, big name American author, were creating portrayals of Jews that were extremely anti-Semitic. Gross's article did not help me with the paper I was writing, but this passage had a profound impact on me.
So this is from Gross. For a Jewish reader, a Jewish character, however minor, looms absurdly large. A casual anti-Semitic slur, however easy and reasonable to dismiss as an innocuous social reflex, reverberates for pages and pages. It may not be right, and it may not be fair, but it is unavoidable. Anyone who identifies himself or herself as a member of any group that is or has been slighted knows that the wary and guarded eye notices that word, Jew, Negro, whatever, half a page away, and that a warning bell, a persistent and insistent, uh-oh, immediately goes off. Now, I'm not trying to compare Mormons to Jews here. We would, of course, lose the oppression derby very quickly, and that's not really my point. Instead, I want to take Gross up on the implicit invitation contained in words and phrases like anyone, any group, and Jew, Negro, whatever, by replacing the term Jew with Mormon. I'm also assuming that Gross didn't mean Shabbat observant synagogue regular when he employed the designation Jew. Instead, I believe the implication is anyone who would self-identify in any way, cultural, spiritual, historical, whatever, as a Jew. Similarly, when I invoke the designation Mormon, I don't mean temple recommend holding food storage order, but anyone who could, for whatever reason, on whatever occasion, self-identify as Mormon. Let's see how Gross's passage reads with the change made. For a Mormon reader, a Mormon character, however minor, looms absurdly large. A casual anti-Mormon slur, however easy and reasonable to dismiss as an innocuous social reflex, reverberates for pages and pages, or long past the commercial break. It may not be right, and it may not be fair, but it is unavoidable. Mormon readers know that wary and guarded eye notices the word, that phrase, Mormon, polygamy, golden Bible, whatever, half a page away, and that a warning bell, a persistent and insistent uh-oh, immediately goes off. Hopefully this rewriting helps illustrate why Gross had such a powerful impact on my younger and thinner self. I know exactly what Gross meant, but the reasons behind that wariness were not the same. Anti-Semitism, like most denigrations of a specific other, takes a specific form. Jews are portrayed as clannish and obsessed with money because people who fear Jews believe, quite wrongly, that they are corrupting the world's financial system so that they can take it over. Similarly, people of Asian descent are portrayed as clannish and inscrutable because of white fears of a yellow peril that threaten colonial hegemony. African Americans are portrayed as lazy and irresponsible because in antebellum America, apologists for slavery argued that people of African descent needed to be guided by their benevolent masters. And in the 19th century, Mormons were portrayed as clannish polygamists and religious fanatics because, well, but the 19th century portrayal of Mormons and Mormonism doesn't hold up so well in the 21st century. It has competition from an ethnic stereotype that suggests Mormons are clean-cut, all-American, family-centered, Republican voting squares. And if you think all of this is an unqualified positive, ask someone who is, say, Hindu Indian American, what it's like to be seen as a model minority. While it's hard to reconcile the two portrayals, the peculiarity of Mormonism's Janus-faced popular ethnic identity represents the core of the question Barry Gross implicitly posed to me all those years ago. What do literary and filmic depictions of Mormons and Mormonism tell us about how American culture sees this self-described peculiar people? After thinking about this question on and off for more years than I care to admit to, and after the 7 people who helped me create peculiar portrayals taught me more than I thought possible about cultural perceptions of Mormons, I have come to wonder if the depictions of Mormonism that have been generated by recent American popular culture have gradually turned Mormonism, or perhaps I should say the idea of Mormonism, into America's first postmodern ethnic identity. I will defend this probably controversial statement after I briefly explain what I mean by postmodernism, and after I pour myself some water, so that I don't hack all over my face. Okay. course, I get the summer cold 2 days before I'm going to present at a conference. There are many definitions of the term postmodern, of course. There should be many definitions of the term postmodern. But I generally agree with Jean-François Léotard's assertion that postmodernism means incredulity towards meta-narratives. For Léotard, a meta-narrative is a story that explains everything for everyone all of the time. Most religion sacred books, for example, are seen as meta-narratives by fundamentalist followers of those religions. Léotard suggests that because of the rational worldview science and the Enlightenment have promoted, the meta-narrative has been replaced by the micro-narrative, stories that explain something for some people some of the time. I would further suggest that the multicultural nature of global capitalism has led to an increasing number of instances where meta-narratives are co-present. The devout Mormon, who has a corporate job in, say, Pittsburgh, and becomes quite close to devout Catholic co-workers and neighbors, or the devout Hindu physician practicing in Salt Lake City and coming to appreciate Mormon culture. And this co-presence strips meta-narratives of some of their meta. After all, my narrative can't explain everything for everyone if my wonderful neighbor looks at the world through a very different set of assumptions. Frederick Jameson further reminds us that a proliferation of micro-narratives works well with the logic of late capitalist marketplace, which needs to maximize profits by effectively targeting specific demographics. Though the flattening effect of these market forces can tend to reduce religious affiliation to the same status as a preference for, say, Kawasaki over Harley-Davidson. As these forces combine to weaken the effective power of meta-narratives, people are more comfortable with the tenuous commitment required of micro-narratives. After all, people age out of demographics all the time, no longer shopping at Urban Outfitters after having naturally moved on to, say, anthropology. Of course, this version of postmodernity has led some critics to posit that the logical conclusion of this line of thinking is that there is no truth. It is understandable why many draw this conclusion, but it is more accurate to say that in postmodern culture there are many truths, and that individuals will usually act on the truths that they are drawn to as if they were absolute truths, at least for a little while, even when they are aware of competing truths. Léotard sees the diversity implicit in an endlessly proliferating collection of micro-narratives as a healthy development for society. After all, it's a lot easier to be an observant Mormon in Missouri these days. Yet, while the freedom from intellectual and spiritual tyranny Léotard finds in multiplying micro-narratives is real, it can also be confusing. One could be left wondering which micro-narrative is, if not absolutely right, then at least right for you. The postmodern is perhaps best characterized by informational entropy, which occurs in communication when a message contains more than one possible meaning. And of course, as the meanings multiply, the informational entropy increases. As society dominated by a meta-narrative would have low informational entropy. There is one way to think about the world, and all one needs to do is to learn that set of assumptions. When there are multiple truths, and a truth seeker has not committed to one of those truths, intellectual paralysis can result from the burden of this choice. Thomas Pynchon's novella, The Clarion of Lot 49, is perhaps the best illustration of the unease that manifold micro-narratives can cause. The tale's protagonist, suburban housewife Oedipa Moss, finds that Pierce Inverarity, a wealthy ex-boyfriend, has died and made her the executrix of his will. As Oedipa travels to San Narciso, the California town literally created by the money Pierce's aerospace company generated, she finds what she thinks are signs of a mysterious organization called the Tristero. The Tristero may or may not have been the shadowy enforcers for the Third and Taxis postal system, which may or may not have competed with the postal systems of Europe, European governments, and the Pony Express. Oedipa becomes obsessed with the Tristero and interviews a range of possible informants that include the last surviving Pony Express rider, an expert on stamp collecting, and a professor who has seen the Vatican Library's copy of The Courier's Tragedy, a play that may or may not be about the Tristero. At the end of Pynchon's tale, all of the information Oedipa has gathered cannot help her decide if the Tristero is real, a symptom of her own insanity, or a trick played on her by Pierce, who had some form of financial leverage over all of her informants. In other words, she is in a condition of high informational entropy because she cannot decide among the equally plausible micro-narratives she has created. At the end of the novel, Oedipo sits back to await the crying of Lot 49, or the auction of a set of stamps that a Tristero bidder may or may not be bidding on. But Pynchon, ever the postmodernist, ends his tale right there. Perhaps what I'm trying to say is that, like Oedipo, contemporary authors, auteurs, readers, and viewers think they may have discovered the existence of a Tristero in Mormonism. Not a shadowy organization that assassinates its rivals while delivering postcards, but a collection of clues that leads an investigator down many different paths. Today, Mormonism is peculiar because it seems to mean so many things at the same time. An overwhelming majority of Americans don't really know what Mormonism is, let alone what it might mean to the broader culture, even though they are probably aware of it and will become very aware of it if Mitt Romney has his way, and may find its exotic otherness compelling. Consequently, American culture, like Oedipo Maas pondering the Tristero, generates multiple explanations of what Mormonism is, each equally plausible and probably mutually exclusive. These possibilities, in turn, create interesting micro-narratives that either explain Mormonism some of the time for some people or multiply the possible meanings of Mormonism. Each essay in Peculiar Portrayals documents different Mormon micro-narratives. Sometimes an essay will provide a different take on the compelling peculiarity of Americans' homegrown religion, and sometimes the essay will see multiple meanings, creating informational entropy. Christine Hutchinson-Jones finds that Tony Kushner sees Mormons as an example of an ethnicity that has abandoned its radical past where conformist present. Michael Austin finds Greg Olson and Will Schiffer using polygamy as a means to introduce informational entropy into American meta-narratives about the family in order to comment on contemporary debates about gay marriage. Kevin Kolkmeier presents John Krakauer's micro-narrative of Mormonism as a violent faith to his class of first-generation immigrants, and finds that his students instead see yet another example of the intolerance of the other that they themselves face every day. Aaron, on the other hand, ably documents the violent micro-narratives informing Mormonism. John Charles Duffy finds non-LDS filmmakers repurposing the carefully constructed missionary micro-narrative in a variety of interesting ways. I, hopefully, document how amenable Brady Udall's Mormonism is to America's post-denominational religious culture. Juliet Wells documents the difficulties Mormon filmmakers face when they try to recast LDS culture to resonate with broader American culture. Perhaps they should have done something with vampires. I don't know. And Karen Austin finds that the makers of reality television programs use LDS participants as signifiers for conservative culture, unless those LDS participants happen to be gay. What to make of all this? Mormon readers should take comfort in the lack of a consistent and common negative stereotype in contemporary culture. No one will ever say, for example, that she got a good deal on a car because she really Mormoned the dealer down. There have been some sympathetic Mormon characters in recent fiction, like the fearless polygamy researcher, BYU graduate student, and returned missionary Kelly D. Kelly is a female character in David Ebersoff's 2008 tale, The 19th Wife, a novel. There have even been the kind of everyday characters who happen to be Mormon, reminiscent of the everyday characters who happen to be Jewish, that so pleased Gross in Sinclair Lewis's novels. For example, the 2006 film Bonneville, which was funded by the Red Hat Society, fascinates me. I don't know what to do with it. It's like a commercial for them after on the DVD. So three late middle-aged, middle-class women driving to California to take one of their husband's ashes to their final resting place. The women's Mormonism features in their characterization, but none of them are in any sense heroic, nor are they psychotic religious cultists or robotic representations of what the 1950s were supposed to be like. And if my limited experience teaching texts with Mormon characters in upper division literature classes at state universities in Pennsylvania is any indication, peculiar Mormons don't have all that much impact on non-LDS readers. For example, after a screening of Otto Preminger's adaptation of Alan Drury's Advising Consent this summer, which features a closeted Mormon senator from Utah who winds up killing himself, I found that my students were largely sympathetic to Brig Anderson's need to closet his homosexuality, and while they saw him as a Mormon, none of the students felt the need to make hysterical or even uninformed comments about those people. Yet while not all characterizations of Mormons are problematic, and here we should remember that Gross had Lewis to read when he was a young man in the 1940s and 50s, Mormon or Mormon-identified readers will nevertheless always feel that distress described by Gross when they read about or see a Mormon character. Understanding what postmodern society can do to a group that is relatively new and poorly understood makes it easier for readers to dismiss the portrayal as a social reflex. However, in a society flooded with information, a group of people who have a shady past and a squeaky clean contemporary image makes the perfect repository for a host of cultural anxieties and aspirations. Want to criticize religious conservatives for their conceptualization of marriage? Make a high-end television series about polygamy. Want to portray a spiritual seeker drifting through a post-denominational cultural landscape? Write a novel about an eccentric who picks up and puts down a totalizing religion like Mormonism. Want to make a movie about a crime-fighting porn star that has some moral heft? Make that crime-fighting porn star a Mormon missionary. Knowing that the broader culture has hopelessly overdetermined your subculture, in other words, can be liberating. And at least Mormon readers can take comfort in the knowledge that if they don't like the current micro-narrative about their culture, another one will be along soon. Thank you.
Well, whereas Mark, for today's presentation, had the very big job of describing a whole set of stereotypes and cultural presences, I have the much smaller job of trying to describe a TV show. But it is a TV show that, at the time that I wrote the article, had run for 2 seasons, and at the time that I revised it, had picked up a 3rd season. So it has a lot of episodes and plots and subplots, and I actually struggled quite a bit with how to get this into a reasonably coherent, focused article. And what I chose to do was to make most of the article an analysis of several scenes that were picked out because I thought they were very relevant to what I was trying to say about Big Love. And what I'm going to do today is just read one of those little scene analyses and then a few paragraphs from the conclusion of the entire article. Title of the article is 4 Consenting Adults in the Privacy of Their Own Supper. And the first scene that I talk about occurs in one of the very early episodes of Big Love, episode 3, Home Invasion, when Roman Grant, played by Harry Dean Stanton, who is the prophet of the polygamous compound where Bill Henriksen, the protagonist of the show, grew up, takes a reporter on a tour and gives a lecture of the history of Mormon polygamy. His son Albie reminds him, "The gays, Papa, don't forget the homosexuals." Roman, initially flustered, regains his bearing and says, "If the Supreme Court says yes to the privacy rights of homosexual persons, surely it's time to recognize our rights to live in peace, too." The well-rehearsed talking point, however, comes back to haunt the prophet. Near the end of the episode, one of his wives excitedly opens a newspaper and reads the lead paragraph out loud. "Roman Grant, prophet and patriarch of Juniper Creek, home to the 2nd largest polygamous sect in Utah, says, we're just like homosexuals." Early in its run, several years before the LDS Church generated national headlines for helping to pass California's Proposition 8, Big Love made the connection between gay marriage and Mormon polygamy quite explicit. It was a major subtext of the show long before it aired, largely because its creators, Mark Olson and Will Sheffer, are longtime domestic partners, and Sheffer's earlier play, Falling Man and Other Monologues, deals largely with gay themes and was written in direct response to anti-gay marriage legislation in California. In an interview about Big Love with The Advocate, Olson said, and I quote, "We have no agenda on this show." Then he went on to explain exactly what, despite having no agenda, the creators were trying to accomplish. There were 3 things we wanted to dramatize: self in marriage, self in family, and self in society. What is it like to be marginalized and deemed off the table of legitimate discussion for who and what you are? Some of the struggles of the characters are very analogous to the gay community of 15 or 20 years ago. These characters are dealing with a lot of self-loathing, and it's ingrained by a society that says you are freaks. In light of these remarks, commentators from both sides of the political debate must be forgiven for suspecting that Big Love may possibly have an agenda after all. This is not to say that Big Love is merely or even primarily a political allegory. It is primarily and merely a television program. But the connections between polygamy and gay marriage run so deep in both legal precedent and popular culture that any treatment of one necessarily has something to say about the other. Polygamy has entered the gay marriage debate in another way, though as the end point of a slippery slope that many conservatives feel must end in its legalization. Justice Antonin Scalia makes an early form of this argument in the cornerstone of his dissent in Romer v. Evans, which overturned a Colorado statute forbidding jurisdictions within the state from passing legislation protecting homosexuals from discrimination. He says, polygamists and those who have a polygamous orientation have been singled out by these provisions for much more severe treatment than merely the denial of favored status. The court's disposition today suggests that these provisions are unconstitutional and that polygamy must be permitted in these states, unless, of course, polygamists, for some reason, have fewer constitutional rights than homosexuals. End quote. As laws against sexual orientation discrimination have created pressure to extend marriage rights, this same slippery slope has become a common argument against gay marriage. Stanley Kurtz, who has criticized Big Love several times in his National Review Online column, wrote in a 2000 article that gay marriage represents but a critical first step towards the legitimation of multi-partner marriages, and then perhaps the elimination of state-sanctioned marriages if we have known it. Once gay male couples with open sexual relationships or lesbian couples with de facto families are legally married, the way will be open to even more imaginative combinations. On what grounds, for instance, could the sperm donor and aging rock star David Crosby be denied the right to join in matrimony with both the lesbian rock singer Melissa Etheridge and her lover Julie Cypher, the, scare quotes, mothers of his child? Kurtz's rhetorical strategy assumes that all right-thinking people already know how terrible it would be to allow a man and two women to join in matrimony. All that he needs to do is point out that gay marriage is the first step in this direction. Big Love responds to this rhetoric by challenging the assumption and asking audiences to at least consider whether David, Melissa, and Julie might not, like Barb, Bill, Nikki, and Margene, form a reasonably happily married family without hurting anybody else in the process. What better way to blunt the effectiveness of a slippery slope argument than to show that what lies at the end of the slope is not that scary? However, Roman Grant and the Juniper Creek polygamists in Big Love are that scary. They represent the side of polygamy that usually appears on the news: violence, intimidation of opponents, authoritarian rule, teenage girls forced to marry septuagenarian patriarchs. By giving Roman the speech tying gay and polygamous rights to each other and showing the sheer horror of the community when these statements are reported in a way that emphasizes its logical conclusion, Big Love resists the simplistic, why can't we all just respect each other's families approach to marriage rights. Olson and Sheffer suggest that the legal fight for marriage creates strange coalitions that are likely to be difficult and distasteful for all involved. We skip now to the end. In its official response to Big Love, the LDS Church asserts that, quote, placing the series in Salt Lake, the international headquarters of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is enough to blur the line between the modern church and the program's subject matter, and to reinforce old and long outdated stereotypes. This objection is especially ironic in light of the fact that the creators of Big Love almost obsessively clarify distinctions among all sorts of Utahns: the good polygamists, the Henriksons and the Embrys; the bad polygamists, Roman and Albie Grant and other members of the Juniper Creek compound; the really scary, mega bad, crazy polygamists, a couple named Selma and Hollis Green; the monogamous polygamists, such as Bill's brother Joey, and the mainstream Mormons. And while the LDS Church spokesman can and should complain that regular Latter-day Saints in Big Love are almost universally portrayed as narrow-minded, self-righteous, bigoted, and hypocritical, there is no possibility that anybody watching the show can miss the fact that these Mormons are not polygamous. They are rather irrationally hostile to polygamy, and the major reason why the show's good polygamists cannot live their lives in peace. The charge that Big Love perpetuates stereotypes about Mormons and polygamy is only partially accurate. Some aspects of the show do tap into existing cultural preconceptions about polygamists. Many, however, do not. Big Love is about much more than marriage arrangements. The actual religious practice of plural marriage occurs so infrequently in American culture that it doesn't even register in demographic tables. These 20 to 40,000 American polygamists exercise a cultural influence that far exceeds their numbers. Mormon polygamy has always served as a test case for much larger cultural agendas. Big Love is perhaps the most significant recent artifact in a much larger cultural movement to change what kind of cases polygamy tests. In the 19th century, Mormon polygamy provided a fertile ground for testing the limits of religious pluralism. Legal scholar Sarah Barringer Gordon's recent book, The Mormon Question, Polygamy and Constitutional Conflict in 19th Century America, and it's becoming a not-so-recent book, but it's a book, explains in great detail the way that the conflict over polygamy shaped the evolution of constitutional law. In a nation that had, since its founding, internalized the principles of both religious liberty and Puritan morality, Mormon polygamy provided just the right background for asking the question, how far must overwhelmingly accepted moral principles bend to accommodate religious belief? The legal precedents established by this conflict, especially Reynolds versus United States, continue to be cited in cases where religious worship bumps up against community standards in questions such as Native Americans using peyote in sacred rituals, Haitian immigrants sacrificing chickens, and religious universities denying admission to students in interracial relationships. It has been some time, however, since polygamy has functioned in this way. While contemporary morality does not accept polygamy, it does embrace so many actions and relationships that are legally indistinguishable from it. There is no legal distinction between a married man who has sex with another woman and, with no authority from the state, calls her a wife, and a similarly married man who calls the other woman a mistress, a friend, or perhaps a White House intern. If there is a moral distinction, it almost certainly favors polygamists, who are at least willing to make some minimal commitment to the women that they sleep with and the children that they commit. Big Love does not set out to challenge laws directly, but to change the cultural definitions upon which laws are ultimately based. Olson is very direct about this aspect of the show. He says, Will and I have watched the country become divisive with an increasingly strident debate about the culture wars and what is and is not a family, and what should be accepted family. What should be an accepted family? He says in an interview with the Washington Blade. We want to examine it at a different level, without labels. Let's take a look at people and find out the values of family that are worth celebrating, separate of who the people are and how they're doing it. The purpose of Big Love, in other words, is to try to change what we mean when we talk about families. And talking about families is the central activity of the American civil religion. There is no more disputed or important question in America today than what makes a family. This question intersects with almost all of the hot-button political issues of the day. Abortion, gay marriage, school choice, the right to die, and the proper role of the government in temporal welfare, to name only a few. In this conversation, and despite differences too numerous to mention, the fictional polygamist in Big Love, Bill Henriksen, and the very real presidential candidate, Mitt Romney, sit uncomfortably on the horns of the same dilemma. Their comforting normalness flows from the same source as their irreducible weirdness. Perhaps the greatest paradox of the Romney campaign was how to take advantage of the candidate's image as a family man, which seemed tailor-made for conservative religious voters, without antagonizing those same voters with his unorthodox beliefs and the less savory aspects of his religious tradition. Henriksen, who embodies the most notorious aspect of that same tradition, faces the same struggle as he tries to build Henriksen's Home Plus into the corporate embodiment of Utah's conservative family culture. Both men, in their own way, symbolize the larger dilemma of Mormonism in America. Mormons are, in many ways, quintessentially American. They're honest, patriotic, hardworking, and devoted to their families. But these values stem directly from those aspects of Mormonism most at odds with American culture. Mormon industry derives directly from the communalism that placed early Mormonism at odds with their Missouri and Illinois neighbors. Mormon patriotism flows from the same authoritarian impulses that turned late 19th century Utah into a strict theocracy. And the well-known Mormon emphasis on families comes from a view of the family as a sacred institution that propels men towards godhood through the creation of eternal posterity, exactly the same ideology that supported the institution of polygamy. The weirdly normal polygamists at the center of Big Love are not, as all of the politically correct disclaimers hasten to point out, affiliated with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But they aren't quite not Mormon. Standing at the fringes of Mormondom, generally, they help to clarify some of the conflicting ways that the story of Mormonism, as a religion, a culture, and a historical narrative, weaves into the much larger narrative of America. And whatever one thinks about the practice of polygamy, it is an integral part of that story. Thank you very much.
Very happy to be here, and thank you both to Michael and Mark for including me in this book. I hope there are many more like it in the future. I've cobbled together a 10-minute version of my other, what would otherwise be a 50-minute version, I think, essay. So it's just a quick summary of what I've tried to do here. It's called Avenging Angels, the Nephi Archetype and Blood Atonement in Nilla Butte, Brian Evanson, and Levi Peterson, and the Making of the Mormon American Writer. The first instance of blood atonement, the ritual killing of apostates, sinners, and Gentiles, appears in the Book of Mormon when God commands Nephi to kill Laban with this justification: "It is better that one man should perish than that a nation should dwindle and perish in unbelief." The story of Nephi killing Laban contributes three key elements into the Mormon mythos. 1, Nephi is archetypal Mormon hero. 2, righteous murder committed by that hero, or blood atonement. And 3, the rhetorical justification for blood atonement. Over 150 years after the publication of the Book of Mormon, we see the Nephi archetype appear in Mormon literature, specifically in three contemporary works by Nilla Butte, Brian Evanson, and Levi Peterson. In LaBute's Bash, Latter-day Plays, John beats Chet, a gay man, to death in a Central Park bathroom. In The Open Curtain, Evanson's Rudd Thurer develops an obsession with blood atonement that leads to the bizarre campsite murders. And Levi Peterson's protagonist in The Backslider, Frank Windham, contemplates suicide as self-atonement for his sins. These three contemporary representations of blood atonement are rooted in the real 19th century expectation that Mormons perform ritualized murder on sinners, apostates, or Gentiles. These representations suggest that the Mormon Church's attempt to bury its own history has failed. Its past is always present, whether the Church acknowledges it or not, and has found its way into these three writers' work. In LaBute's short play, A Gaggle of Saints, which is part of a trilogy called Bash, two Mormon characters, John and Sue, recap their trip to New York City from Boston with two couples from their church group, during which the three men severely beat a gay man in a Central Park bathroom. The violence in A Gaggle of Saints, at least from the hero's perspective, is what Marilyn Wesley calls constructive violence, enacted by the young male protagonist who is seeking a power that confirms community values. In other words, they punish Chet because he is gay. But the audience sees it differently. It is difficult to imagine anyone condoning what John and his two friends do to the man, and LaBute's relentlessly violent portrayal leaves no doubt how we are to interpret it. A Gaggle of Saints investigates John's assumption that the violence he and his friends commit is constructive, and in so doing show how destructive it is. The play bears a chilling resemblance to the real 1998 murder of Matthew Shepard, who was tied to a post and beaten to death because, according to the two men that murdered him, he made a pass at them. And just a note for those of you that haven't read the play, it's relentlessly brutal and long, and so it's worth looking at if you haven't. In Brian Evanson's The Open Curtain, the protagonist, Rudd Thurer, brutally murders an entire family after immersing himself in the study of 19th century blood atonement rituals. Evanson depicts the campsite murders as a contemporary blood atonement ritual transmitted through the myths and psychology of his cultural ancestors, making it clear that when an institution, in this case the Mormon religion, disassociates itself with its past, that past rears its head in one way or the other. In the afterword to his novel, Evanson writes that the undercurrent of violence in Mormon culture really hasn't changed, that the conditions that made violence well up in earlier Mormon culture are still very present today. These conditions, or situations as Carl Jung calls them, activate the Nephi archetype that lies dormant in Mormon culture. Labute's hero punishes the sinner in a gaggle of saints, while Evanson's hero fights off history as it is traveled down through ritual. Both heroes commit murder, as does the first Mormon hero, Nephi, in the Book of Mormon. In Levi Peterson's The Backslider, Frank Wyndham's impulse to harm himself as atoned for his sins comes from his repeated failure to live a Mormon life. Frank, a 21-year-old Mormon cowboy living in small-town Utah, cannot measure up to his religion's standards, cannot help himself from sinning, and believes that these sins are beyond the power of Christ's atonement. Again, if you haven't read this book, you need to read it, because he goes to great lengths to prevent himself from masturbating, for example. He constructs an anti-masturbation contraption that sort of ties him to the bed and prevents him from touching himself. And he also won't eat any food that tastes good, for example. So he's obviously taking this to an extreme. Frank's own guilt and shame activate a slightly different version of the Nephi archetype than Labute's John and Evanson's Rudd, but one that typifies the Nephi archetype. Rene Girard puts it this way in Violence in the Sacred: any community that has fallen prey to violence or has been stricken by some overwhelming catastrophe hurls itself blindly into the search for a scapegoat. In Frank's case, that search turns inward, and he convinces himself that he is the lone individual at fault for all of his problems. He believes that God has designated him as the sacrificial victim because he cannot live a righteous life. The Backslider builds to the moment when Frank will either kill himself or change course altogether. If Peterson chooses blood atonement suicide for his hero, then the novel would, like A Gaggle of Saints and The Open Curtain, suggest that the legacy of blood atonement these heroes inherit from Mormon history is too much for them to bear. John from A Gaggle of Saints believes he has slayed the dragon in killing Chet, but Labute's play shows us how destructive John's worldview is. Rudd from The Open Curtain loses himself when he enacts blood atonement on an innocent family in the campsite murders. His novel suggests that the burden of the past, when buried, might also bury those in the present. The Backslider takes another turn. Frank does not kill himself. Instead, he sees a vision that reconfigures his understanding of Christianity. Moments after Frank baptizes his Lutheran wife, Mary Ann, into the Mormon church, he is alone in the men's bathroom when Jesus pays him a visit, dressed as a cowboy. The cowboy Jesus seen in The Backslider has become an iconic moment in Mormon literature for at least two reasons. The first is that Frank's shame and guilt are exposed as gratuitous spiritual masochism. All through The Backslider, Frank believes that the onus is on him to live a perfect life, and if he cannot, to atone for his own sins. Ironically, while trying to be a good Christian, he has overlooked the basic tenet of Christianity, that Christ offered up his own life to atone for the sins of others. In the cowboy Jesus scene, Peterson attempts to undo the theological underpinnings that led to blood atonement in the first place. Followers of Christ should not take up the business of atoning for anyone, themselves or others. They should instead believe that Christ's blood was enough. The second reason is practical, where the first is theological. What one calls Christianity in the cowboy Jesus scene, another might call cognitive dissonance. Jesus tells Frank to lighten up, to get over the notion that he should be perfect. To illustrate this point, Jesus smokes, a clear violation of Mormon doctrine, but remains committed to his religion. He also tells him to have sex with his wife, to lighten up, to eat good food, and just to basically enjoy himself. The counterpoint to Jesus is Frank himself, who without any cognitive dissonance is ready to kill himself for his sins. Readers of LaBute, Evanson, and Peterson might imagine Mormons as a people who stand ready to kill others or themselves for their religion, and indeed such a view of Mormonism is more tantalizing. The reality is that, like many Mormons, Frank must find a way to maintain conflicting Mormon principles in order to live his religion. He represents the average contemporary Mormon who, when confronted with the details of his own cultural history and his own perfection, finds a way to reconcile it enough within himself to stay in the religion without killing himself or others. The motivation for this study came out of my desire to understand the pervasive violence I saw in contemporary fiction and drama by Mormon American men. The bubbly, squeaky, clean public persona of the contemporary Mormon runs in stark contrast to the Nephi archetype we find on the pages of LaBute, Evanson, and Peterson. In fact, these authors have created heroes more like those from Hebrew scripture, Samson, Abraham, King David, to name a few, who kill for their God. I had thought that the violence in fiction by these contemporary Mormon authors had more to do with rebelling against that squeaky clean image, a way of projecting a more complicated Mormon identity to a non-Mormon audience. But what I found was that these writers are writing from within a Mormon tradition drenched in violence, a tradition rooted in both Mormon scripture and Mormon history. What further motivated my study is how American these three Mormon authors are. Harold Bloom argues that Mormonism is one of the few distinctly American religions and writes this about Joseph Smith. I myself can think of not another American, except for Emerson and Whitman, who so moves and alters my own imagination. For someone who is not Mormon, what matters most about Joseph Smith is how American both the man and his religion have proved to be. He also posits that sometime in the future, a major American poet will write their early story as the epic it was. I suggest that the American religion has already produced American authors who tell the Mormon story, but not quite in the manner described by Bloom. The textual violence we find in LaBute, Evanson, and Peterson makes their work typically American and should place them in the conversation about contemporary American literature. Thank you.
Is this working? Okay, we have got all kinds of time for questions. Like, everyone here can ask 5 questions. So, please, go for it.
Yeah, I found this a very interesting and enlightening presentation. I'm surely going to buy a copy of your book.
Thank you.
You sold at least one copy.
That's 2 total.
Yeah, so, I'm very interested I'm working on a book dealing with polygamy itself, but my specific question is on the dilemma of Mitt Romney, and I, as you're well aware, in the last campaign, you know, he was forced to give his so-called Mormon speech, and when confronted with the issue of polygamy, I think it was on 60 Minutes or something, he made the statement. He says, "I cannot imagine anything more awful than polygamy." Even though his own ancestors, of course, were polygamous. I guess my question is this, as a kind of a sequel to that. How do you think, number one, I guess a 2-part question. Number one, how do you think Romney is going to attempt to navigate his way through the Mormon, I guess what would be the larger issue, the Mormon question vis-a-vis, you know, all aspects, the weirdness, polygamy, whatever, and how should he navigate his way through? Because it, by all appearances, it looks like he's shaping up as a major contender in 2012. That's a political junkie question.
My guess, as a fellow political junkie, and I know Mark will have opinions on this too, my guess is that Romney will probably be the candidate and that he will run the primary very differently, because now the primary is going to be who can beat the evil Obama. And I think that he's going to run against primarily right-wing whack jobs.
He's going to go to the right of them to get the nomination.
He's going to go on electability. I think he's going to present himself as the electable candidate, and I think the Mormon issue is going to be much more subdued next time, because the whole conversation in America has changed, and people are much less concerned with does he wear garments and believe that the Garden of Eden is in Missouri, as they are with, you know, here's somebody with strong fiscal credentials who has been a successful governor of a, you know, somewhat liberal state, and we're really upset and we want somebody who can win. And I think that's the tack he takes against, say, Sarah Palin and Mike Huckabee. As to how should he address it, I actually have in my mind written the speech that I think he ought to give. But he probably won't give it. But it goes something like this. It's none of your damn business whether my ancestors practiced polygamy, because that's not what I'm running for.
But you know, that question got Obama in trouble. I'm not producing a birth certificate.
Right.
Are you still practicing polygamy? Is that why you haven't produced records of your grandparents?
Right.
The media's not going
to... Oh, yeah. You know, he asked what he should do. I don't think there's a chance that he will do it. But I wish he would say something like, "You are not... I am not running for priest. I'm not running for pope. I'm running for a secular office, and please do not apply a religious test to me because it's unconstitutional to do so." That would be what I would like him to say, but I don't think he will. I think he will probably be much more successful evading the question this time, though.
Because it's been brought up before.
It's pre-vetted, and because I think within 2 years the main concern of Republican primary voters is going to be to win and not to to make sure that he's religiously appropriate. Just a guess.
And I'm going to not be as specific as Mike, but maybe offer a more theoretical counterpoint. Postmodernity is not an established fact. It's a mode of dealing with the world. Some people are more embracing of diversity, to put it in a more. And it's the Democrats that are more embracing of diversity. And the base of the Republican Party, if we use the sort of rubric that I'm using in the paper and in the chapter, they're anti-postmodernists. They want a meta-narrative. And I say that as somebody who studied... I'm saying this next thing as somebody who studied with Frederick Jameson's student and as someone who served a Mormon mission in Georgia. We don't fit very well into their meta-narrative,
right,
into that hardcore right-wing meta-narrative. And so I think Romney has a sort of fundamental cultural reality that might just, you have to win the base, and you have to sound the right way to the base in electoral politics, because the primaries are a different election than the general election. And I'm just not sure that what Mike said, that would work great in October of 2012, talking to genuinely independent voters. But I don't know how that's going to play in say, I think Georgia's primaries in March. I could be wrong, I'm not a political scientist, but, it's mine. I don't know how that would play in March in Georgia, because you have a meta-narrative, and the meta-narrative is a highly religious, evangelical meta-narrative, and we do not fit, or the place that, the role a meta-narrative assigns observant Mormons is not the kind of role that anyone who would be elected president would be. And so that's, I think he screwed it because of the primaries. I think if he could skip the primaries and go to the general election, I agree with Mike. But
you don't see him getting through the primaries then?
Nope.
See, I think that a few polls showing him beating Obama and Palin losing to Obama is going to take care of that, quite honestly.
Since you said you have lots of time for questions, I have two questions, I guess, and they're slightly different. The first question relates to the Big Love, and I wanted just to hear your thoughts on the endowment scene controversy and the church's response to that controversy and how the church interacted with that. The other question is a different track, so I'll mention it and then you can address it later. It's about filmmaker Richard Dutcher and his movement from active Mormon filmmaker to non-Mormon filmmaker making R-rated horror slasher movies, and what that says about Mormon filmmaking or the culture of film in Mormon society.
Is Mormon filmmaking dead? That's what I keep hearing. It's not going to be...
To go to the Big Love episode, I didn't work it into this article because there was no place to put it within the framework that I was working with. I did watch the episode, and I think that it was as well presented and tastefully handled as you can be in presenting the endowment ceremony in a public venue. However, you simply cannot be anything other than offensive doing that. I mean, if it were possible to publicize the endowment ceremony in a non-offensive way, they would have done it. It is, however, impossible to do so. It is inherently offensive to portray the endowment ceremony to Mormons. I was pleasantly surprised by the church's response, which, as I read it, was, don't get your Mormon undies in a bunch. It's not that big a deal. Don't go boycotting and thinking it's the end of the world. Just deal with it. I mean, that's how I read the church's response. And I was proud. I thought that was the right response. They're not trying to bring a lawsuit. They're not trying to organize a boycott. They just said, let it alone. Which I thought was the proper response.
Do you think that's done because of the result of Prop 8? There was an unnamed person quoted in the LA Times saying, they messed with our religion, they offended us, we gave them back in spades. I think that's kind of what...
I don't think it was that. I don't think so. I think it was a fairly natural outgrowth of where the show was going. And I think that that there is inherent interest in the Mormon temple ceremony. And there was a lot of buzz. And I think that episode, let's face it, the main purpose of Big Love is to make money. It is a television show. And that episode got a lot of buzz and had a lot of viewers and increased HBO subscriptions. So no, I don't think it was a tit for tat. I think the producers knew exactly what they were doing. There are former Mormon writers on the staff of Big Love, and with just a few exceptions, they tend to get the Mormon stuff just about right. Now, there are some exceptions.
There are times when I'm sorry, but there are whenever they do church process, as far as like bishop level or high council level stuff, I'm just amazed that there's nobody around you that you could ask and say, would a bishop's office look like this? I mean,
and that's true, and and it's probably not realistic that Barb was able to go to the temple by stealing her sister's temple recommend. And, that was a little bit silly. And they portrayed this as her first time in the temple endowment ceremony, even though she was previously described as having a temple marriage, which isn't true. But what I'm saying is the producers have enough access to Mormon information to know that showing the temple endowment ceremony is a big deal to Mormons.
Well, I like what you said in a private conversation we had. You made a comparison, but it was wonderful. You said it was a tasteful depiction of the Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you just can't, you can make Muhammad into the most heroic, wonderful, attractive person that would make, a secularist in downtown Salt Lake or Brussels go, maybe they're not so bad. And Islam would freak out. And I think that's what they did with Big Love is they made this wonderful, beautiful thing that the woman who hired me into my first job, it was a Big Love junkie, and she was afraid to show it to me, and then she showed it to me, and it was okay, right? But I heard back from her, Mark, that was beautiful. That's wonderful. As to your second question about film, buy the book and read Juliette Wells' article. Because she talks about the, I should have looked it up, the Mormon version of Austin's Pride and Prejudice, and how they tried to market it to a non-LDS audience and how it kind of didn't work. It's a very interesting discussion. And I think that answers your question, or at least it's a good place to start thinking about it. Mormon cinema, by definition, has a limited audience.
And so maybe we could use, it's like there was a bubble, right? Like you can build a certain number of McMansions in Pittsburgh or Salt Lake, and they'll sell. But if you build five times the number of McMansions that you need, and then you give people subprime loans to get into those McMansions, you're going to have trouble. So if you film a certain number of LDS-themed films that do not reach out in any way to non-LDS audiences, there's a market for it. But if that market gets overbuilt, the bubble's going to pop and things are. And that's kind of what I see happening, is that they, you know, Dutcher made money with God's Army. Everyone, you know, just like people are making money selling McMansions, you know, an hour outside of San Francisco, well, hey, let's build a lot of them. Well, hey, let's film a lot of them. Right? Everybody loses their money. Larry H. Miller dies, and that funding source dries up. My cousin was Larry's attorney. And I said to my cousin, I know you can't give me details, but was Larry a soft touch for Mormon filmmakers? And he just shook his head and laughed and walked away and said, don't talk to me about this, Mark. So obviously, you know, and so so Dutcher's problem is, you know, he can't, if he's a contractor and he can't go build McMansions anymore, but, you know, the stimulus package is saying, let's build a highway over here, he's going to go and try and build a highway. So, you know, he can't make money making Mormon films right now, but he can make money with Z-grade slasher films, or at least thinks he can. He's got kids, he's got a mortgage, you know, and that's you know, my take on that.
Well, it's too bad the Mormon audience wasn't there for States of Grace. I mean, they kind of abandoned him from that point on.
Yeah. Okay, and please, I'm asked to remind you to please come up to the microphone so that we can get everything on the record.
My comment has to do with the first question. My mother's father, who's a physician, was a polygamist in Logan, and had four wives. So my mother lived in polygamy. I kind of know what I'm talking about.
Right.
As far as my mother was concerned, she was a highly educated woman, and she never said anything negative about the principles or Mormons. But I have to tell you that I agree with Mitt Romney. I can't imagine anything worse than living in polygamy. So, you know, and I respect my ancestors and all that, and I respect polygamists and what, you know, and their offspring. But I agree with Mitt Romney on that one point.
Duly noted.
His campaign people are outside for you from the commercial.
Yeah, Aaron, In your presentation, you talked about, essentially, at least the way I heard it was, you know, this has, you know, is Mormonism to some extent. That's violence, and then you linked it to Americanism, that violence is an essential part, I guess, of both characters, or at least that's the way I heard you say it. Could you comment further on that, how they relate, and why you see it that way?
Well, yeah, gladly. I was obsessed with trying to write about Mormon literature as a subset of American literature. So I was looking for connections, ways of kind of putting it into the literature that I was reading, and the violence was the most common theme, trope, whatever. It really struck a chord with me when I read Richard Slotkin's Regeneration Through Violence. He's an Americanist. I guess he would probably consider himself part of American Studies, right? Kind of a new historicist, American Studies guy, who did this huge three-volume study of the frontier culture in American history and American literature. And I knew right away when I was reading this that I did the same thing. Actually, I don't have the quote with me, but you substituted Mormon for Jewish. I substituted in a particular quote Mormons for early Americans. and how they saw a need to how they were forming their own identity against what they'd left behind, and that this often included a kind of violence. And it also made sense to me that communities. Let me just back up. I found out that what I really liked about what I found out is that Mormons aren't as strange as I thought they were. They're part of a system they have their own. They're fairly typical of any community, is what I found out. That communities use violence to protect themselves, and that blood atonement was nothing more than our version of what communities have done since Rene Girard documents it all the way back.
Since our ancestors wiped out the Neanderthals,
that communities have always used scapegoats to protect their own interests. So I felt so excited by this, and I was liberated in a way. I thought, we're an American religion, as Harold Bloom said. So for me, that was an enormous revelation. And then I just kind of went back to the literature, and I started to notice that these things were. Because I was obsessed with Evanston and LaBute for a while. Why are they so violent? Why, either physical violence or emotional violence, like in The Company of Men, for example, was the first thing I saw from Neil LaBute. So anyway, I hope I answered your question.
Well, just to follow up, so you were correlating it with literature. Non-Mormon, Mormon literature. I think he answered the question. Do you see the ethos of violence as a telling part of both Mormon and American mythology or Mormon character?
Absolutely. So, but again, we're not unique. We're just American. So.
I don't know if my question really has a place here, but because it doesn't directly respond to what you said, but I've been intrigued of late by these Mormon commercials that they're showing where I live in Colorado anyway, that where the message seems to be, to me, a Mormon, Mormons aren't that peculiar.
The We're Not Weird campaign.
Yeah! Can you talk yeah. about that a bit?
I think.
Have you seen it? I mean, I'm the kind of person that watches a little TV, and I certainly tune out the commercials. So then I don't catch on that that's what I'm seeing until I've missed actually the first part of it. But.
Part of my weirdness is we don't have a TV in my family. So.
I think they're excellently done. I mean, have you seen them? I mean, there'll be a girl. There will be something going on, and I don't even know how to describe them, but there's this longboard surfing champion, this attractive, maybe Hawaiian girl, and just talking very positively about life, and then eventually she'll say, and I'm a Mormon. And
you're like, I'm a surfer, or I'm a mother, and all these things.
Yeah,
They're commercials put out by the church.
Yeah.
And,
It's
the New Mormon.org website.
Pardon?
The New Mormon.org website.
Oh, that's right.
Their videos from there, and they also release them as commercials.
I think they're so well done. I can't say enough about production values or how kind of subtle the Mormon part of it is.
Yeah, I have colleagues that work in St. Louis. In instructional media and that kind of stuff, and they're just it's like, you're a Mormon, can you get us in touch with the people who produce this thing?
Is that right?
Because they're just, because of the production values.
Yeah.
Very, very slick.
Really
no, and I think that the churches, that there are different issues here of the church, rightfully so, doing PR. And the church has always been really good at PR. And this might impact public perception. But the sort of artistic endeavors are going to look at weirdness, because if you think about it, if you're reading a novel or watching a play or a movie, there's something different. Or why are you why are you investing in it? You know, that fictions tend to focus on the out of place, the uncanny, the exotic other,
right.
and not so much, or at least successful fictions or fictions that survive their own shelf life as an object for the marketplace. And so I think the church is well aware of pretty much everything in here, and is realizing that in the public space. They don't want South Park to define who we are.
Right. So, or Big Love.
Or Big Love, or even something relatively kind as the Miracle Life of Edgar Mann. So this is, they're fighting back.
And it would be really cynical to think that it has anything to do with Mitt Romney and trying to get us ready to vote.
Well, let me.
Without me going too way too far.
I'm going to take the director's privilege and read one more paragraph here. Because I did try to address this head on. What the Romney campaign brought out was that most people still do think Mormons are weird. And I see a 2007 Pew survey taken during the height of the Romney campaign reports that polygamy and bigamy were the most frequent responses when participants were asked to describe Mormonism with a single word, followed by family, cult, and different. This perception is reflected in news reports. A LexisNexis search that I did myself of articles written between April 2006 and April 2008 showed that of 120 articles mentioning Romney's religion, 22% discussed polygamy or plural marriage. The same percentage of articles about Mormons or Mormonism generally discussed polygamy. One in five public mentions of Mormonism brings up the practice of polygamy still. So the church is dealing with the fact, and I think Romney's campaign really brought this to the surface, that the we're not weird message is not getting out. And so you have some very sophisticated, well-done, very expensive public relations attempts to just build a little bit of brand recognition of Mormons as a non-weird part of America.
Although, I mean, it is a branding, but in John Charles' essay on the Mormon missionary image in film, he documents very carefully how the church has created that missionary image over the years. He did some research here in the church's library and looked at old mission president's handbooks. And then he looks at how films like Orgasmo take that image and twist it around. And I think his argument is, because the church makes that available, it's like setting out, it's like throwing a dead cow into a tank full of barracudas. The people are going to come to it and repurpose it. So I think that while it's understandable that the church will do PR, any organization will do PR. Anyone who thinks that an organization shouldn't do PR is not living in the real world. However, when that PR is done, when that brand is created, especially in our media, the way people repurpose things all the time, it's going to get repurposed. And I wonder if that weird image is, it's not 1955. it's not going to be this sort of straightforward, oh, they're not weird. Instead, it's probably just going to, set off more, oh, really? Really, you're not weird? Really?
Feel for satire, yeah.
Really, Mormon boy, you're not weird? How many wives did your grandpa have? Yeah, okay.
I would like to just add, I wish we'd celebrate the weirdness more. Because that's what makes us unique. I mean, we don't want to be evangelical Christians. I mean, no offense, I live in Georgia right now, but we should celebrate Joseph Smith's genius.
Are you saying we should let our free flags fly?
Yes. And, we do still practice a kind of spiritual polygamy. And that's okay. So what? Our history is rather young. But I sort of like what Michael said, that it's none of your business in a way. That there's got to be a little bit more belligerence from our point of view, saying, yeah, so what? I mean, you're Catholic. You think that you eat the blood of the body of Christ every week. So what? I don't think it's... I mean, the weirdness should be more democratic and shared.
But again, the problem is that the audience you're addressing, the church is addressing right-wing conservatives in this country.
Right.
Right-wing conservatives are not comfortable with what you're essentially, I mean, it's essentially a multiculturalist argument. Hey, this is who we are. It's interesting or not, but leave us alone.
Yes.
My son just happens to be the CIO for the church, and he was sort of involved with it, mm-hmm. this .org thing. He's a brother to John D. Lynn, mm-hmm. and it's kind of weird because he's over here and John's over here, and with him going in his direction from his stories, and I have my son Joel is the CIO for the church, and it's kind of a strange thing. Somebody could write a book about that. But my comment is that I love the South Park Mormon. I even got a tear in my eye. I thought it was so sweet. But I'm with you.
Well, the ending was great. I mean, when Cartman says, "Oh, you're cool," you know. Yeah.
And being made fun of by South Park is almost proof that we've become normal, because they make fun of everybody. And if we don't get made fun of, they're equal opportunity annoyers.
There's no such thing as bad publicity. Tell your son that there are people who study this stuff for a living that I work with who are blown away by the quality of these commercials.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just, whoa.
And can we get a sense in here maybe of where they're being shown and where they're not? Like,
yeah.
I just saw the, I had it on my phone a second ago. It's like 8 markets. I think it's
really?
Baton Rouge, Minnesota, St. Louis,
Colorado Springs.
Jacksonville, Colorado Springs. I had a list, but I just moved away from it.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, I didn't know.
It's
being test marketed, or if that's where it's needed
the
most. Yeah, that's right. Where the focus on the family.
I would also connect this back to the book by saying that Mormon film is not dead, nor is Mormon literature dead. It's just taking a while to kind of work itself into the mainstream. When I have meetings with my agent and I'm pitching him ideas, whenever I give him the Mormon ideas, he starts to move in his seat. And I still write them sort of alternating with other ideas.
The sex with mother Mormon part has got to balance it out a little bit.
That's right. But I just have this sense that, like you pointed out, they want to make money. So if they can sell books with Mormon characters, they don't care if they're Mormon or not. And if the films make money, the filmmaker will get to make more films. It's just getting more and more prevalent. I mean, Brady Udall's new novel is one of the most celebrated novels of the year. What's it called?
The
Lonely Polygamist. And this is just, Mormon writers and Mormon filmmakers, Mormon artists are just, they're going to be more and more comfortable just integrating Mormonness into their work.
And I think we also have to keep in mind that excellence is simply a statistical function of mediocrity. You have to have a whole lot of mediocre film and literature before you get the few that are great.
Think of all the crappy, crappy, crappy high school quarterbacks who graduated with Brett Favre. And then think of all the mediocre ones who played college ball when he played college ball, right? So it gets that kind of numbers of people involved in it, you're going to have. But I think the marketability issue is problematized by the church's marketing efforts, right? That if the church is saying, oh, we're normal, we're this to right wing conservatives, then that puts a sort of burden on people who, I mean, let me just say that I think if you surveyed most people in the pews on Sunday, they would not want to let their freak flags fly anywhere. And so the church, the church culture is kind of going one way, and arguments like leave us alone, or, hey, this is interesting, they go a different way. It's a diversity argument. It's an argument that embraces postmodernity. It's an argument of liberals, if not the left. And that's a tension that's going to need to be resolved, particularly when
the church gets involved in spectacular political battles like the Prop 8 thing. And after what happened yesterday, you know, your agent might get more and more comfortable before this thing plays out completely.
I want to go back to the Brady Udall novel. What would you attribute, I guess, the success of the novel on two levels? The fact that it is, you know, attracting a lot of attention. I guess it's selling pretty well. I think it's in the top 20 on the bestseller list right now. And its success commercially, and it's also been had very good reviews, generally speaking. What would you attribute those two successes to? I don't know if you read it or...
I've read a little bit. My article is on his first one, on the Edgar Mint. And Udall embraces the very sort of rhetoric that I'm talking about. He lets his freak flag fly, but he turns it into a micro-narrative. And so, which a lot of churches, like these big mega-churches... Right, they don't have their denominational affiliations anymore, right? It's Joel Osteen's church. It's not First Houston, you know, Presbyterian, right? And it's a post-denominational environment. It's more about the individual's experience than the master narrative of Lutheranism or Catholicism or Mormonism. And so Udall presents Mormonism that way, as an intense personal spiritual experience, but that is a micro narrative or a demographic that can be aged out of. You can pick it up, you can put it down. That's the way a lot of people see religion these days. They want to go to church, but they don't necessarily care if it's the Methodist church or not to say that there aren't dedicated Lutherans out there, but there's enough people out there that because Udall, and particularly Edgar Mint, framed Mormonism that way. This is a legitimate spiritual experience, but it doesn't mean your spiritual experience isn't true, and it doesn't mean that Mormonism explains the whole world. If you look at the passages in Edgar Mint, where he describes things like priesthood blessings, you know, you could read that over the pulpit in the most conservative ward in the world, and they go, yeah, that's exactly how it is. Yet Edgar himself explores sort of the seamier side of Mormonism, and of course... there's a lot of talk about masturbation. Maybe that's it.
It's a trope in Mormon fiction.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
Yeah, and so he shows to a secular reader, it's like, okay, obviously Mormons have a reason for sticking. They feel something. There's something spiritual there. But this doesn't mean that I have to buy the whole Joseph Smith shtick, right? I can say, oh, there's spirituality there. It's not threatening. It matches most people's experiences where they're more spiritual than dogmatically denominational. And that's kind of my argument, is that this is how you talk to non-Mormon and non-Mormon audience.
And let's face it, polygamy is interesting. It sounds fun. I mean, people want to know about it. There is this subculture in the United States that has a long history of spectacularly fascinating crimes. And polygamy has been interesting for a very long time. Mark Twain and Arthur Conan Doyle and Robert Louis Stevenson wrote interesting novels about polygamists. Well, Twain's was an interesting memoir, but it gives you dramatic possibilities. Big Love has opened up dramatic possibilities that you just have not seen anywhere else. You know, two wives conspiring against a third to bring in a fourth. You don't see that in most shows. So there really just is an inherent, I think, sustained interest there that's not going to go away. And what will go away is us, though, because we are now out of time. Thank you for the questions. They were the best part.
Yes.
And book is on sale next door.
1:30,
I believe.
1:30.